Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a weekly discussion of the Torah portion of the week. I am your co-host, Aaron Roller, and I'm here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
Hello, hello.
So, we've got a pretty big week this week with the end of the Ten Plagues.
Yeah.
We got the darkness. We see a darkness coming. But I wanted
locusts to... Locusts first.
I wanted to tell you first about a new hobby I'm developing with my kids.
I'm afraid.
It is called geocaching. Do you know what that is?
How do you spell caching? C-A-S-H or C-A-C-H?
C-H.
I don't.
So there are...
Had you said S-H, I would have said, of course.
What would that mean?
It's when you hide money in rocks.
This is pretty close, actually. There are apparently little boxes and bags of just like little treasure, which like i.e. like tchotchkes and stuff, hidden all over the world.
What?
Yeah, people hide stuff and then they log the location where they've hidden it on their phone on this geocaching app, and you can access the app and go looking for their treasure. And when you find it, you can log that you have found it. You can, and use also a little sign-in sheet in the box. And then you can take the treasure and replace it with something of equal or greater value, or leave it as is. So me and the kids went out. I told them we're going on a treasure hunt, and we found some stuff. It doesn't really have much to do with the parsha. It's just that what's going on with
you. You know what is remarkable? I actually think that's kind of refreshing, because I have been growing increasingly concerned that the entire world's population, or at least the entire country's population, is becoming increasingly glued to a screen. And I understand that there seems to be an app component here, but even so, the idea that maybe there's this trend of people actually like going outside and getting into nature and doing things that are creative, that's awesome. Much better than Pokemon Go.
Yeah, it's like Pokemon Go, but real.
But real, yeah.
Right. And also, like, the kids, right, it has the screen component, but it's got, like, latitude and longitude. They're, like, kind of, like, you know, becoming we got off the beaten path. There's a couple right here in the neighborhood. It's interesting.
Well, Aaron.
Yes?
Let me tell you. I've hidden a few gems in this week's Parsha, and it will be your mission to uncover them.
Great segue. So
did not rehearse this ahead of time.
You might be surprised to hear.
Yeah, it's an off the cuff segue.
So this week's parsha really picks up where we left off last week, where we're in the middle of 10 plagues. And anything to say about why there are 10 plagues in particular?
So I started thinking about this, I guess, riff on the 10 plagues. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about Rabbi Yehuda last week and about how Rabbi Yehuda divides the plagues into three different components, effectively 333. Well, let's assume 333 and then Makas Bechoros.
His mnemonic, yeah.
Right. So the Tzach Adash Ba'achav, placing the first three, the second three, and then the third three. And then the final one is sort of it's the grand finale. Makas Bechoros is a grand finale.
The coup de grace.
Yeah, I haven't. This is a totally half baked idea. But I was just thinking about comparing and contrasting the 10 plagues to the 10 commandments in the following capacity. There's you know, many have spoken about the importance of seeing the 10 commandments specifically divided on those two tablets for a reason, meaning to say that they're parallel. And we know that the first tablet was supposed to deal with items that involved our relationship with God, and then the second tablet pertains to our relationship between man and man, but that they parallel one another, and that there is almost like a symbiosis between 1 and 6 and 2 and 7, and there's a conversation effectively that's being had between the two tablets in that capacity. I was wondering if you could look at the plagues in the same way, which would frame... I was talking about Dever, about the pestilence this past week in Shul, and about how that might actually be something of like a forerunner to Makas Bechoros, to the final plague of the firstborn.
Mm.
Similar sort of idea about God skipping from one home to the next, passing over the livestock of the Jews and only striking or only smiting the Egyptian livestock. Everybody wakes up the next morning. There's a lot of death. There's a lot of blood. Very strange. It's due to a plague. No animals, you know, throat has been slashed, and yet they're just laying dead. The Egyptians look in their stables and their barns, and they're all destroyed. They're all decimated. And then the Jews look in theirs, and everything is still sort of intact. And there seems to be something of a parallel there. So I wonder about thinking about the plagues in that capacity, sort of 5-on-5.
Are there others? Have you figured out?
I'm not sure.
The other 10, I mean, I think there's like three, at least three that I think of off the cuff of, you know, sets of 10 in the Torah. There's the 10 commandments and the 10 plagues. And I think the other one is the less famous, but still pretty well known, 10 ma'amara, the 10 instances of God saying, God uses the word and God said,
right.
God speaks 10 things which create the world. And that would seem to sort of be an appropriate parallel also, in the sense that he is unmaking Egypt. He is sort of taking control of the forces of nature. I'm certainly going backwards. Again, you know, I don't know. And I talked about this last week. It doesn't seem like there's a really neat way every single one makes perfect sense, but definitely the Makat Bechorot, you know, this destroying the firstborn versus creating the first human, as the final of his statements in creating the world, that would sort of seem to parallel itself as well. But it's but Egypt certainly gets thrown for a loop, and the parsha begins with Pharaoh being sort of not conciliatory. He sort of says, oh, "We're going to go. You know, I'll let you go. Says, I'm going to let you go. Wait, who's going actually?" And Moshe says, everybody's going. It's a kind of rhymes. It's a Miami Boys Choir song, I think. Is that right?
I think it's I want to say Avram Fried.
Avram Fried.
Yeah. Yeah,
you can check it out on YouTube probably. But
I'm sure you will.
Anyway, but he says, oh yeah, we're taking our animals also, and Pharaoh's like, wait, what?
The little kids, the elders, everyone, we're all going.
So one thing that struck me on that is that then Pharaoh changes his mind. Now, on one level, it talks about God hardens his heart, but on another level, there's something to be said here about, I don't know, equality, or about just the idea that everyone's going to be celebrating together. Now, of course, it's also the subtext. It's sort of a ruse. I mean, like, it's not that they're taking the children so they can also worship. They're actually planning on. It seems like they're really planning on leaving. They're not necessarily going to come back. But the bottom line is, at least at the point that Moshe is arguing with the Pharaoh is about, like, who gets to worship. And one would imagine in Egyptian society, it's like, no, take the men and go. And when Moshe says, no, the children have to be involved in this. This is a religious experience for everybody. That's there's something powerfully... I don't know if democratic is the right word, but certainly
inclusive.
Inclusive, thank you. That's I think what I was looking for.
Yeah, and that it's so lost on him, that it's just so completely lost on him. At least on one, you know, on one level, if that's what's going on, that it's just so completely lost on Pharaoh. The idea that these are values and this is an experience that we need to ensure inculcated into the minds and the hearts of the children. Therefore, they need to be taken with us. Everybody has a place. Everybody has a role, because it's not just a function of how, you know, of how big a building can you make and what can you create and what sort of structure are you going to be able to construct. It's about this experience of just connecting and celebrating God, and that's something that everybody has to take part in.
And in point of fact, the interesting thing is that Pesach, which this becomes, is one of the Shalosh Regalim, a time when in ancient Israel entire families would go to Jerusalem to celebrate. Like, it really, that idea of everybody celebrating together became reality.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's not mandated with respect to future Pesach or future holidays the way it is here. That Moshe was saying, no, we all got to get up and we all gotta leave. We all need to celebrate together. Not necessarily so when it comes to, let's say, Pesach of you know, Aliyah LeRegel going up to Jerusalem for the actual festival, where the actual obligation, strictly speaking, devolves upon the men. Maybe not so for Pesach, but at least when it comes to some of the other holidays. Everybody had to eat of the carbon Pesach, and that can only be done in Jerusalem.
Yeah, and you'd have to bring an animal.
Correct.
So right. that experience that he's describing is one which did actually play out. And then
I just want to go back to something that you said. It was a throwaway line,
mm-hmm.
but let's exploit it a little bit. Okay. The idea that this was all a ruse...
Yes.
Why is it all a ruse as opposed to a shift or a different, you know, change of heart or change of mind that took place at some later point?
Well, they've been saying the whole time we're going to go for 3 days.
Right.
If Pharaoh says yes,
right,
are they going to come back 3 days later?
Right.
I mean, I don't think. I mean, that goes. And we talked about this 2 weeks ago on Shmuel that, like, you know. We spoke about this in the sense that God says, I'm going to take my people out, you know, go tell Pharaoh to let my people go. And that's not exactly what Moshe says. Moshe says, we're going to go and worship in the desert for 3 days. And I pointed this out and said, God doesn't appear to reprimand Moshe or tell him that he didn't follow his instructions.
Yeah,
to the
I think he's delivering the message exactly as he was supposed to.
So there's something, but
meaning yes, if Pharaoh says fine, go for 3 days, I don't presume that Moshe and the rest of the people would not have been true to their word. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has actually an amazing approach to this entire issue, and he spells out just this. He really believes that that at no point was there subterfuge, that when there was an offer made that we would go out into the desert and we would celebrate for a number of days, we'd be out there for a holiday for a week and then we'd come back, that's exactly what it was going to be. It was going to be that and nothing more. And effectively, what he suggests is that what it was meant to be, right? What's the purpose then? The purpose is that there's a lot about this. There's this famous note made by the Arizal, by Rabbi Isaac Luria, the great Kabbalist, who said that the Jewish people in the time right before the moment of the Exodus were so far gone, or at least in the moments before the plagues or during the plagues, were so far gone that if we think of spiritual purity and impurity as effectively existing on a 50 point scale, they were right at point 49. I mean, they were about to just spill over the edge of spiritual impurity, never to return, become completely assimilated, be more Egyptian than the Egyptians, and there would be no Jewish people left to save. And what God was basically proposing initially through Moshe to Pharaoh was that let them go and recharge their batteries, let them go and have this moment with me and celebrate with me for a little while, and they'll be able to go back and they'll come back and they'll basically complete the full blown commitment or the full blown punishment, if you will, that was actually prophesied during the Bris Ben Habesarim, during the covenant between the parts. Right, there's this funny issue with the math here throughout this entire process. That there is this promise that they're going to be foreigners, strangers in a strange land for 400 years. They're only there for 210.
Will they still be slaves at that point?
That they would come back. They would be slaves. They would be enslaved, but that it would be a different problem. But they would be able to hold their own and hold on to things for a little bit longer. And then they would leave when they were supposed to leave after the full 400, without all the funny recalculations and all the math going back to the times of the patriarchs themselves being outside of the land of Israel and being strangers in a strange land, even though they weren't actually in Egypt. And that was a genuine offer. And and basically Pharaoh looked the gift horse in the mouth and said, forget it, I'm going to hold on to you. And there's this realization that almost twofold. I don't remember exactly how Rabbi Kamenetsky puts it, but perhaps a combination of the two, that Pharaoh's never just going to let them go for a few days unless I pry them out of his grip, number one. And that number two, if the people come back, if the people stay any longer, whatever it is, it's just not going to work. It's not going to work to have them leave and come back. It's just, it's not going to go. So we're going to have to do it sort of prematurely. We're going to have to do it now. Rabbi Kamenetsky actually makes a very, very interesting notes and interesting parallel later on in Jewish history. He says this effectively is what the Second Temple was. The Second Temple was sort of like a recharge that had we just entered out into the exile, into the diaspora, following the destruction of the First Temple, we would have been so completely lost and assimilated that there would be no Jewish people today. And effectively bringing at least a component, even if not the majority, but bringing a strong component of the Jewish people back to the Holy Land, back to Israel for a number of centuries with an actual Beis HaMikdash, gave them the opportunity to sort of recharge. But it was known from the outset that this was just going to be a shell of what the original temple actually was, minus many of the miracles, just not the same degree of autonomy, et cetera, et cetera. But that effectively you find this as something of a theme throughout Jewish history, that God gives us these opportunities sometimes they work out, sometimes they don't, to sort of recharge the batteries and be able to rejuvenate, reinvigorate ourselves, if only for the time being, so that we can then last longer over a more difficult period thereafter.
So I find that fascinating.
I do too.
I think it requires, a little like some detailed rereadings into what Hashem tells Moshe in Shemot, where he says, "I'm gonna take them out to the place, to the land flowing with milk and honey." And he says in the third chapter, the 10th verse, "Now go and I shall dispatch you to Pharaoh, and you shall take my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." So you'd have to say out of Egypt, but only for 3 days.
Yeah, or that this is a promise for the future, meaning tell the people that I'm really with them, that I'm here for them, that I haven't forgotten them, and they're going to go out and they're going to celebrate, and ultimately I'm going to bring them into the land of milk and honey, not necessarily yet. Or that basically what's happening, this is a very difficult thing, right? This is why this entire episode, right? These parshiot become a very, very difficult, sort of become a thorn in the side of explaining how free will is meant to operate, mm-hmm. right? Maimonides has a very difficult time, not really a difficult time, but he makes a point of dealing with these issues of how can it be on the one hand that God knows exactly what's going to happen, and yet we claim that we still have free will. So you see this in a couple of different ways. On the one hand, it seems that Pharaoh loses his free will in the sense that his heart is hardened. It also seems that God perhaps is predicting things that are absolutely going to happen, even though ostensibly Pharaoh should have the opportunity to determine otherwise. Right? He talks about from the God, meaning talks about from the outset how he's going to leave Egypt to waste, and Pharaoh's going to refuse, and he's going to have to harden himself. Who knows? Maybe if Pharaoh really has free will, maybe on the very first time we'll say, you know what, Moshe, I gotta tell you, it's a reasonable request. You guys have been, your people have been working hard for us for the past 200 years. Go ahead, enjoy 7 days off, have a blast, celebrate, take my keys, enjoy. And God knows from the outset that it's not going to happen. How much of this is God telling Moshe that this is what's going to happen because I know that Pharaoh will never take the bait? And how much of this is perhaps not letting on that Pharaoh's not going to take the bait, but maybe is just making a statement about what is absolutely going to happen at some point in the future, even if it is yet further afield? You're going to go to the land of Israel. I'm going to take you there, but maybe it just won't happen quite yet. There's going to be this, holiday and this festival in the interim, and that's going to help you again recharge the batteries, go back to Egypt. It's really, really unclear. I mean, this is the challenge in trying to read any of the dialogue in the Torah, is that it's all and you need the almost biographical information, right? What was really said? What was really happening? What's the subtext? What's going on behind the scenes? What happens in the broader context of these conversations? Not just the very short little snippets that we're getting, very difficult to actually ascertain. But at any rate, that I think is a very, very valid approach to me in this entire the read of all these parshiot. And I like it because I think otherwise it's just so odd to me. It's so odd that when God is there pulling all the strings, doing whatever he wants, overturning nature, the supernatural, the miraculous, 10 Makot. Egypt is just left absolutely destroyed and a shell of its former self. Why would you need to pull the wool over anybody's eyes? Right? You have a god on your side who is bringing clouds of locusts, turning the Nile into blood, casting all of Egypt in a blanket of darkness. Why do you have to play these games? Oh, you know, maybe we'll go out for a few days. We'll come back. And something that always bothered me about it.
It's a very interesting and on a certain level, very straightforward approach. This segue works on a number of levels, but this idea you talked about from the RE, that the distinction between Jew and Egyptian is very minute at this point. I thought that was kind of like it was something which that idea struck me that in terms of the purpose of all this, that when Moshe announces the prophecy of the death of the firstborn, he says, this is in chapter 11, verse 7, Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Zayin. He says, in prophesying that there's going to be this slaying of the firstborn, he says, so you shall know that Hashem will have differentiated between Egypt and Israel. That on a certain level, that, you know, God is saying quite explicitly, the whole purpose of this exercise was to make a distinction between the Egyptians and the Israelites. And I think, so that's sort of one way that segues. I think the other one is the way that the Rambam Maimonides addresses this question of the free will, which to my understanding is that that Pharaoh's free will is taken away almost, that's the fitting punishment for what he does by enslaving the Jews.
That's right.
That it's really a case of the punishment fitting the crime, because and that's, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think who says this, but someone was talking to me about this this weekend, I think, that the entire, like, what it all boils down to, what the idea of slavery boils down to, is the conception that you don't matter. The idea that your actions don't make a difference, your time is not your own, your very existence is not important, and your consequently your choices don't matter. And so that's the exact opposite of what God wants from us in this world, is for us to feel a tremendous sense of relevance and to feel a tremendous sense of power, and that there is significance to our actions, despite the fact that we are very, very limited in terms of, you know, the space we occupy and the time we occupy. And so to take away Pharaoh's free will and leading him in this destruction, and we talked about this last week, I had sort of suggested the idea of this as a form of addiction, that you know, he's sort of addicted to a status quo, but that's really, I don't know if that's a fully satisfactory, I don't know if it's a fully satisfactory answer on a philosophical level, but certainly on a literary level, it's very compelling. To contrast, again, the contrast of, you know, the Pharaoh to the Israelites, the Egyptians to the Jews, the, you know, the paganism, the polytheism to the monotheism. I mean, it's all kind of coming into play here.
Yeah, I like the framing of that, because what's so interesting about this story, and I think you find this with some of the symbolism and the iconography, even that matzah. Right, matzah is probably the prototypical icon of the entire story, of the entire Pesach Seder, because it's meant to represent what? Well, really represents two different things, right? Matzah is the bread that we eat because we left Egypt in great haste, didn't have time to actually let the bread bake. Of course, we say at the very beginning of the Seder, that this is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate when they were yet in Egypt. Remember, we see it in this week's parsha, the night before, right? It's kind of eerie. The night before the Jews leave, the night before they have dough that they don't have an opportunity to let rise and be baked into regular bread, God says, eat the actual Pesach offering, and eat it with matzah, because why, right? Matzah isn't relevant yet. Well, matzah really is relevant because they've been eating it for 210 years, meaning matzah is also the bread of affliction. It's the bread of slaves. It's the bread that you would bake if you just don't have time to let your dough rise because you're busy being ushered back to work and back into slavery. So it's so interesting, right? So there's this pivot on the one hand from being slaves to being free, and yet the freedom isn't a pure, I don't want to say untainted, but it's not an unfettered sort of freedom. Meaning to say that there are expectations, right? They don't just become liberated. They don't just become physically free. It's like they go from matzah to matzah. They go from not having enough time and time not being their own because they feel the whip on their back to time not being their own because now they don't have a pharaoh to answer to, but they have a god to answer to. Now they have this awesome responsibility. They have to constantly be busy. They have to run. They have to go. They're busy being freed, and that's really the life of a Jew, that you're constantly answering to the obligations that we have in this world, to perfecting this world, perfecting ourselves, being closer to God. 613 mitzvot, tens of thousands of laws, an immense and infinite Torah that's out there that needs to be studied. So I think it's such an interesting way of framing it, right? That on the one hand, they're going from there really is no distinction, right? I was busy before, I'm busy now. I was an eved before. Probably the greatest accolade we could bestow upon anyone is that person is an eved Hashem. Right, that they are serving, that they're serving God. I go from being a slave to being a servant, from being a servant to being a servant. So what's the difference? The difference isn't free will. The difference is that God doesn't want us to be people who are ushered from one project to the next against our will. God wants us to be people who exercise our free will in the service, in his service, in the service of him, in the service of Judaism, community, nation, etc. So that free will really, that's the kicker. That's the linchpin. That's what makes the difference between what is worthless oppression and what is very worthwhile service.
I think it's become a recurring theme that we talk about the fact that words have multiple meanings and multiple inferences that come with them. But I think that the idea of the Eved Hashem, the servant to God, versus Eved Leparo, the servant to Pharaoh, is that the distinction is in the free will and in the difference in that. At least I'm pretty certain God created us with free will because he wants us to choose to worship him freely. I think that that's pretty inherent in our belief system, that it's all dependent upon free will, which is also why we get so, it's like there's only one case, I think, in the whole Torah, right? I don't know if there are any other cases where someone's heart is hardened, and yet it opens up this like philosophical black hole that we like can't.
But how do you answer this? Yeah.
And yet, like in the end, you're like, well, he's punishing him. Like, but we really are bothered by it because free will is so important to us. But I think that another message that I would take, I like the dual nature of the matzah, and something that I think is really comes to the fore. We talked about it a little bit last week, but it really jumps to the foreground this in this week's parsha is the idea that this is being done for the future. I mean, just reading this parsha, you feel like you're already celebrating Pesach. You feel like you're a couple months in the future, or maybe going back through your past Pesach Seder experiences. But it's totally explicit. Like God says, I'm going to do this so that you will tell your children. And that language that you will tell your children comes up four different times in this week's parsha, which we then carry on to the Pesach Haggadah and the four sons, and the framework of education, and that this is done not just for right now, but this is being done to make an impact for all time, that you're going to have an experience that becomes something that your family tells you about, something that you recount for all time, is like it's done in a self-conscious way. It's not just like, oh, that was amazing, I have to tell my kids about it. It was like the person doing it, God in this case, is like, I'm going to make this amazing so that you will tell your kids about it. And what's interesting is that this comes through in the matzah not explicitly, but it's really, I mean, when you're reading through the Torah portion this week, it's so firstly, I mean, I'm not even, I don't want to put you on the spot. I certainly, you know, as I continue to, I sometimes continue to spend time with the Parsha after we record. And the outstanding questions for me are about the number of times and the number of different ways that the commandment to celebrate Pesach come through. Like Hashem tells Moshe that you're going to tell them this, then Moshe tells it to the elders, then he tells it to the people, then it's recounted a little bit at the end, which I do kind of want to get into. But like, it's just, it's there a lot, and I don't know what all the distinctions are. If you have insights, I welcome them, but I don't want to put you on the spot. But the other thing that comes through is as you're reading about this obligation to commemorate Pesach, Passover holiday in the future, is the first time it's recounted, it says, make this meal, right? It was a goat or a lamb, right? It's a goat.
Yep. One-year-old.
Yeah. And
a kid or a lamb.
Right. Take it for 4 days, and you're going to sort of have it waiting for 4 days, and then you're going to slaughter it. And when you eat it, you're going to eat it with this matzah. So that was commanded. And then when it's recounting how it actually went down, it says they didn't have time to finish baking it, and they had to take this dough with them, and it turned into matzah, which is where we get the idea that matzah is this food. Like, it's got both of the elements. This is the food that they ate regularly, and God's saying, oh, yeah, eat that matzah that you always eat. And then they don't actually get the chance at the time to do what God asks them to do. They are in the middle of this meal when they've got to pick up and go.
But that's a new matzah. That's a new matzah.
What do you mean?
Meaning the matzah that they needed to eat with the lamb, they ate with the lamb. Right, the dough, the provisions that they were going to take the next day, because you're going to take provisions with you, whatever dough you have, whatever flour and water you quickly mix together to be able to take along with you for the ride, they had to bake very quickly into matzah.
I think it goes through, it's in the portion where it says it was at midnight. It's getting to the time when the Makkah Bechor, the plague of the firstborn, is taking place, and it says Pharaoh yells and says, "We got to get these people out of there." And then it says, chapter 12, verse 35, Parak Yud Bet Pasuk Lamed Ahay, it says, "The children of Israel carried out the word of Moses. They requested from the Egyptians silver vessels, golden garments. Hashem gave it." No, that's not where I wanted to go. Two verses down to 39. "They baked the dough that they took out of Egypt into unleavened cakes, for they could not be leavened, for they were driven from Egypt, for they could not delay, nor had they made provisions for themselves."
Right, but that's not the matzah from the night before. I mean, matzah from the night before, God says, you're going to have to eat a Karban Pesach. You have to have this animal, you have to have this lamb. You have to have the lamb along with matzah, along with maror. That's how it's got to be eaten. And they're doing all that. By the time midnight rolls around, that's in all likelihood been over and done. Fast forward to midnight whenever it is that Pharaoh comes streaking through the streets in of whatever city they're in downtown Egypt. And he says, everybody out. Just everybody get out, pick up and go. And now the people go about asking and borrowing silver and gold. And meanwhile, what about their provision? Like, what about the dough that they're meant to take with them on the road? The whole idea is that this is dough that they would have allowed to become leaven, but they didn't have time. So instead, they very quickly baked it into matzah, similar to the matzah that they just ate a few hours before.
So I don't know. I mean, that's certainly not how I read it. And I also think I will talk about the Abravanella is, so it's, again, I think I jumped the gun. It was actually verse 34. It says, "The people picked up its dough before it could become leavened. Vayisaha am et betzeko term yechmat." So you're saying,
wouldn't it be odd to make up to highlight or to underscore the fact that the children of Israel picked up the dough before it had a chance to leaven, if they were already, I mean, isn't that obvious? God commanded them. He said, you have to have it as matzah. You can't have it leavened because it's supposed to be for the Pesach Seder. But this isn't what they're eating at the Seder, at that first Seder in Egypt. These are the provisions that they are then meant to take out with them that ordinarily would have allowed to rise, but we're leaving in such chipazon, in such haste, that we don't have time to allow this to actually rise into leaven. So they bake it quickly, they bring it out as matzah. Which again, which is just so, it's like shocking, it's so eerie. God commanded us just a few hours ago that we had to make a point. It's like prophetic, right? He told us that we have an obligation to eat this sacrifice along with matzah. And then just a few hours later, we find out what exactly the symbolism of this matzah was really meant to be about.
So that's exactly what I was going to get into. And maybe it is different. Maybe I misunderstood that it's different matzah, in fact. But yeah, that's what I was going to quote the Abravanel, the Spanish commentary, that exact idea that it's commanded, and then like, but it's that same idea that like this is being done in order to be symbolic for all times. That like you get the commandment, you have to eat the matzah, and then they actually act it out. Now, in my mind, which again may be misunderstanding, but it seemed more resonant and more almost poetic that they are commanded and they don't even get the opportunity to enact it. Like the thing that they're supposed to do, they don't get to do, but that becomes the symbol for the reason why they were doing it in the first place. Perhaps that was my misunderstanding, but I think either way,
it's eerie. It's like, you're doing this thing. You don't know, you know, there's this tradition. I believe Rashi quotes it as well, but famous rabbinic tradition. Yeah. Rashi does quote it that when the angels came to visit Abraham, it was Pesach, right? And he was eating matzah. And everybody asks the question, or everybody almost like chuckled, ha ha ha, like how could that possibly be? I mean, Abraham lived far in advance of the Exodus from Egypt, and matzah wouldn't have been relevant. Pesach wouldn't have made any sense. And you know, assuming we take that very literally, I think this is a really interesting insight that sort of harkens back to that moment. The idea of Abraham perhaps having been privy to all kinds of mitzvot as being almost absolute truths of behaviors, activities that would have connected him to God, even though historically they yet had no context, they yet had no meaning in terms of the actual chronological passing of time. Like nothing had yet taken place for this to be meaningful, only that God says to do it, that this becomes part of his Torah. And that perhaps even the night before, even before this moment happens, it's still very meaningful to the Jewish people that they're sitting there eating matzah. God says to do it. We don't really get why. We don't understand why. And it's not until a few hours later that it all really snaps into place. It all really clicks. Oh, you know, it's like something. It's like a scene from like Back to the Future, right? Like,
yeah, totally.
Yeah, like it only makes sense in some other reality. Only once it happens in the future does it make sense in the past somehow. It's this wild idea. Now, on a very simplistic level, I mean, I really would come back to the idea that this was bread that they were eating for two centuries. Or this was the same bread that it's almost this, you know, much like the bitter herbs symbolize clearly the idea that they had embittered lives in Egypt. Matzah represents the idea that they had embittered lives in Egypt because they didn't have time to actually let their bread rise. And then it becomes almost more ironic that here, for 200 years, and it was even, you know, institutionalized, almost codified in the form of this mitzvah that we just fulfilled a few hours ago when we had this Seder that God commanded us to have. We're supposed to eat matzah because this is supposed to be the bread that is reminiscent of all the hardship and all the labor and all the busyness that we had when we were in Egypt. And now, but a few hours later, they're so busy being saved and they're so busy being redeemed that they likewise don't have time to actually let it rise.
So something that occurred to me, I was thinking about this, that idea that Abraham's eating the matzah, specifically because I was thinking about the destruction of Egypt and what we talked about last week. Is it destroyed because it's, you know, like you said, is it because it's a human rights violation, or is it because they're messing with God's chosen people? And I was thinking about like, well, when else does God kind of put his foot down? And that would be in the case of the destruction of the city of Sodom. And it struck me as very interesting that occurs in quick succession with this, you know, this quote unquote Seder that Abraham is having, that we have the destruction of this city. Now, it doesn't, I don't know how exact the chronology lines up or what the larger significance is, but it's just, it is a parallel, I think, that's worth exploring. And, you know, it is something which I did sort of think about all through the week. And I certainly agree, we don't see God swooping in for every time, a nation is subjugated. I do think that just the fact that, like, this is what God is telling us is wrong, right? Like, this is wrong behavior. This is not what you're supposed to do. Like, we're clearly seeing that God does not like when you enslave people, because when you enslave his people, it's considered a bad thing. So we certainly should take away from that, like, that this is not a good thing.
Absolutely. I think just the way that
And I don't think you were saying that it was okay.
No, I'm not saying that it's okay to enslave people. Right. I think that I would just make a distinction between, I guess, the manner in which the behavior of the Egyptians is just depicted. And I don't even know that it's depicted in any sort of, it's sort of like the winners write the history books. Yeah. I don't even know if you need to go that far here. There's nothing that talks about the Egyptians in a particularly negative light, other than seemingly at least describing the events that happen. But sometimes simply describing what is taking place and actually seeing those words on paper is just startling. How could people, and you get it from the perspective of the people who are actually being oppressed. And I don't know that the Egyptians ever stopped and actually considered that. And I think that in of itself is very telling, right? It just jumps off the page. This is not appropriate. These are real people here. These are real people with real families, with real concerns, who want to save their children. And you're throwing their babies into the Nile, and you're herding them off to do your bidding just because of some imaginary phantom of an idea that they're going to run off and join the other side. It's so wrong. It's so foul. It's so treacherous. I think that becomes apparent from a simple description of the actual events as they unfolded, as they transpired over the course of these generations. I think the idea that therefore you have this people that is freed, you have this supernatural the space-time altering kind of experience that lasts for an entire year, where these plagues are taking place, and Egypt is being just wrecked and destroyed, and God makes a point of saying that I'm like separating you out from them to be my special nation, my chosen ones. That idea of chosenness, I don't think is fair or appropriate to I guess bestow upon other societies, where we believe that there's something special and unique about the Jewish experience.
I think we're on the same page with this one. That perspective sort of it came up as you're thinking about the plague of the firstborn, where you read about the extent, and it even talks about the animals are going to be killed, and like the firstborn of the animals, and you're like, for at least for myself, reading it for a second, I'm like, wow, that's really it's pretty harsh. And then the dawning realization that this is a sick society, that it's an entire society that has been complacent in the enslavement and the murder of these babies. And so, I mean, not that the animals were, but the point is that God kind of unleashing that retribution, totally makes sense. And it doesn't seem over the top. It's pretty gruesome. It's pretty intense. But again, it's the entire Egyptian society is being implicated. And in that same verse that it talks about, from Pharaoh down to the maid servant, to the maid who's at her millstone, and the animals. It also says, and I'm going to render judgment on the Egyptian gods. So I think that ultimately the idolatry, the polytheism is wrapped up in that immorality as well. And so that's what it is. And I totally, yeah, it's a sick society that's being judged. And it's the one which is being distinguished from a very different society, which we're going to see emerge in the coming weeks with the revelation at Mount Sinai. The last thing I wanted to bring up was, and it's in keeping with this theme of, like, there are things which you're going to do to continue to remember the Exodus. A lot of things come up, and including them are tefillin are kind of mentioned. It talks about you're going to have these straps, which is, you know, it's a hard commandment to understand anyway, kind of seems to come out of nowhere. But then stranger still, I think, is this commandment that you have to redeem the firstborn donkeys. It's kind of just mentioned there at the end. like it just seems a little bit incongruous with like the intensity of this plague and being redeemed from slavery after 200 years. And they're like, oh, and by the way, you're going to have to like pay the priests some money, like trade a sheep for your donkeys or something. It's like, it's very weird. Do you have any thoughts or insights into this?
Well, and it's something that I wanted to bring up before, because you mentioned how many times the idea of making sure that you tell your children that you're leaving and that I took you out of Mitzrayim. I was just going to mention this point that the idea of certain mitzvos serving as a commemoration for leaving Egypt far exceeds the ones that we would typically think of, right? We would think obviously about things that we do at the Seder night, the idea that we have a mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim every Seder of actually relating the whole story of the Exodus from Egypt. And then obviously all the attendant mitzvos of matzah and maror, all of those, and we know that it's mentioned it's mentioned as part of Shema in the third paragraph of the twice daily reciting of Shema. So there are all the obvious ones, and then then it comes up in Tefillin, and it comes up in redemption of the firstborn. It comes up in so many different places, and without necessarily harping on the symbolism of every individual mitzvah, I think it's what this speaks to is that this is an event that needs to wind its way through almost every dimension of Jewish living, of religious experience for the Jewish people from this point and onward. This is that critical. This is that important. And it really is Shabbos. We mention right in Kiddush that Shabbos is supposed to serve as a commemoration of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Now, we understand that it serves as a commemoration of the or recognition of God having created the world in 6 days, resting on the seventh. But how does Egypt find its way into Shabbos? The idea that everything that we do, and again, there's important symbolism that's specific to Shabbos. There's important symbolism that's specific to Tefillin, important symbolism that's specific to even the redemption of the firstborn, all of these mitzvahs. But we find that this is something that just weaves its way through our entire relationship with God as a nation and as individuals from this point and onward. It's just that important. The idea that God didn't just create the world and then say goodbye. God has a mission. God has an objective. He wants to see something happen. He wants to see something special take place with his chosen nation. And if they need a little bump in the right direction, he's going to make sure that it happens. Come hell or high water, he's going to overturn all of every law of nature that might otherwise be standing in his way in order to make sure that this takes place. No problem, no holds barred, no issues. Everything will be triumphed over. Everything will be surpassed in order to make sure that this all takes place. And that God has our back again and again in the most miraculous of ways, if necessary. This is supposed to be an event that lasts for all the rest of time, that reminds us that whatever we might believe we see with our own eyes, God is, he might be hiding behind the curtain every now and again, but he's there. He has a mission for us and he's guiding us every step of the way. And don't be fooled by whatever natural forces we might otherwise see presented in front of our very eyes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are looking forward to getting to next week with the splitting of the sea. We're very much in the middle of one of the most exciting stories in the Torah. This is a good conversation, but there's still so many things. My head is spinning from all the philosophic and halachic and just narrative questions on this week's parsha. It's something we'll say it in a minute. There's so much to learn about this one. So we're gonna wrap this up. Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Magid's Niggin by Simply Tzvat. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play. Leave us a review wherever you're downloading it. It really helps other people find the show. Follow the show on Facebook. Get involved in the conversation. Shout out to Yehuda Shupper for sending us a Dvar Torah. We enjoyed that. And have a good Shabbos. Remember, there is always more to learn.